And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial, and the rest of the world at cfmu.ca, our online streaming service. I'm joined today by David Swanson, and he is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He's executive director of worldbeyondwar.org, a global nonviolent movement to end war and establish a just and sustainable peace. He's also the author of various books, including one that we're going to be discussing today. He co-authored that with Medea Benjamin, and it's called NATO, What You Need to Know. So, David, thanks very much for joining us on the program today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Well, Tamara Lawrence had brought up your name and had talked about the value of the work you're doing with regard to both this recent book on NATO and a summit that's coming up, which I should probably mention. I'll mention it a few times. That summit is called No to NATO, Yes to Peace. And it is a summit and a rally in Washington, D.C. on July 6 and 7. And it's about NATO 75th anniversary and the protests thereof. And we can talk about that, but I think your book really opens up a lot of the issues that you would want to address in that summit, I think. Here in Hamilton, with the anti-war activities we do, we like to point out that NATO is an aggressive military alliance, something that a lot of sovereign countries probably wouldn't want creeping up onto their border. But people might not understand why that is. But your book details that to some extent. I think you talk about how NATO has remade itself and the old purposes that it existed for have disappeared. And yet it's been part of a lot of wars in the last 35 years or so. So I'm wondering, can you tell us what it is that NATO's been up to in the past three or so decades?
Might take three or more hours to cover a bit of that. But yeah, NATO is turning 75, and presidents and prime ministers will all be gathering in Washington, D.C. And we hope to have buses coming from Canada and people coming from around the world to Washington, D.C. to suggest that there's a better way. And there needs to be a better way, because NATO has gone from 16 members when the primary excuse it used for its existence and all of its activities for its first decades disappeared. The Warsaw Pact ended, the Soviet Union ended. People actually believed, honest, good, well-intended, intelligent, educated people believed that if the primary excuse for all the wars around the world, all the militarism and all the threats and deterrence and nuclear armaments disappeared, so would they, and we'd get a peace dividend. But of course, the drive to dominate other countries and sell weapons and control economies and so forth didn't change one iota. And NATO went from 16 members to 32, added dozens of partners around the world, and started waging wars that had nothing to do with any attack on any NATO member or threat to any NATO member, wars that it couldn't even get all the NATO members to agree to join in, but got a bunch of them, wars in Bosnia, in Serbia, in Kosovo, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in all the buildup that's developed into this war in Ukraine. These are the things we have to thank NATO for. And so you could say, well, the people of Sweden and the people of Finland, they're afraid. They don't mean any ill will, but they're afraid. They mean it defensively. They want to join NATO. But the more you add nations all up and down the border of Russia to NATO, the more Russia gets afraid. This is a vicious cycle. This is an arms race. And it is risking all life on Earth. This is not hyperbole. This is what it's risking when you're ever closer to nuclear war.
Yes, certainly we in Hamilton have protested many of these NATO actions. I got my start in anti-war activity protesting NATO dismantling Yugoslavia in 1999, which was an extremely aggressive act that changed the borders of Europe forcibly. And more recently, NATO's attack on Libya, where it dismembered or certainly destroyed the Libya that used to exist. So you can see, I mean, there's numerous examples. I mean, Libya was particularly egregious. NATO provided air cover, basically an air force for militant groups that violently killed Gaddafi. And how is the rest of the world to take something like that? You know, in the case of Russia, you mentioned Russia, we're looking at NATO expansion. And anyone who would say that Ukraine is a war of NATO expansion would be called a Russian propagandist or something like that. And yet, NATO has basically admitted that in its own rhetoric, that the expansion of NATO onto Russia's borders or towards Russia's borders is something that upset Russia, but NATO refused to back down on that. So basically, the NATO expansionism is igniting this conflict in Ukraine.
Well, no question. It's a war of NATO expansion. It's also a war of Russian expansion. The presence of one party doing something disreputable doesn't make an angel of everyone else in the vicinity. It just doesn't. This is, you know, infantile thinking. But there is no doubt, and the Secretary of General of NATO tells us publicly that it was the expansion of NATO that created this war, that all Russia wanted was a commitment not to expand NATO. And in fact, 1 month into the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, rather shaky NATO member Turkey hosted negotiations at which Russia, by all accounts, was ready to depart and end the war with just a commitment not to join NATO. And that was unacceptable, not to Ukraine. It was unacceptable to the United States and the United Kingdom, which told Ukraine no and have told Ukraine repeatedly no toward the end of last year again. And now Russia's not offering as good a deal. Now Russia wants to end the war, keeping the bits of territory it's taken from Ukraine, you know, but it's hard to get as good a deal this far along. And both sides know perfectly well that they're not going to win, that they're not going to overthrow the government of Ukraine or the government of Russia, that this is just going to go on and on and on with deaths and deaths and deaths, unless it escalates, unless it becomes a world war, becomes a nuclear war, or it ends. And the deals are just going to get worse and worse for everybody. You know, sooner or later, you got to destroy the world or negotiate a peace. And this is what NATO is against. You know, NATO is for a peace summit next month in Switzerland without Russia, at which they talk about how peace would be obtained by whatever Ukraine might wish, never mind what Russia might wish, which, of course, is not negotiating at all.
Yes, you know, in Hamilton, the activities we've undertaken have strongly encouraged negotiation at every juncture, right? We think that essentially there has to be a negotiated settlement to this, negotiated solution, because of the massive dangers that are involved with escalation and the massive devastation that has already been wrought by this conflict. Unfortunately, it often seems as if things are getting more intense and the risk of escalation grows. We're already been in a kind of Cuban Missile Crisis situation for the last 2 years or so. And it's even starting to shock people within NATO. I saw the news in the last 24 hours or so that Italy, for example, its ministers, the prime minister even, have been shocked at NATO's Stoltenberg, because he was saying, why not provide more offensive weapons to Ukraine to hit more targets inside of Russia? And I think that, you know, recently has included parts of Russia's nuclear radar facilities, things that are designed to detect and understand nuclear attacks. So that's part of its nuclear infrastructure. So this situation where NATO members are starting to ask questions, how does that fit into the picture that you're painting about NATO?
This is a process and a cycle that's been going on for years and decades. You know, top U.S. officials were warning for decades that threatening to add Ukraine or Georgia to NATO would result in a war just like this. And some within the U.S. openly intended as much. Others were simply willing to risk it. But now you have the Secretary General of NATO saying the U.S. needs to allow its weapons to be used inside Russia. And Russia saying this will mean world war. And, you know, but who is NATO? Who elects NATO? Who gives any power to NATO? Who is NATO to be badgering its dominant member publicly to get even more aggressive? And, you know, this is from the Russian point of view, very much like the Cuban Missile Crisis on steroids. I mean, this is as if the U.S. states that were once part of Mexico went back to Mexico and joined a hostile Mexican military alliance and lined up nuclear weapons on the borders of the U.S. Central Plains and Midwest. You know, this is what it's like to them. And so you have a right-wing, slightly nutty Prime Minister Meloni in Italy come out against World War III, and people scratch their heads. Oh my goodness, what am I to do? What should I think? Should I be against risking all human life and other life on Earth, or should I not? Because I don't like Giorgia Meloni. I mean, this is the thinking that people have been reduced to. Yes. Yes, you should oppose risking all life on Earth. And no, there isn't something worse called bowing down to Putin. Russia isn't one evil cartoon. Russia is a nation with a government that needs to be negotiated with like any other government. And if you want to be able to prosecute Russians for their crimes, stop doing everything in the world you can to tear down international law and sabotage the international courts that support the very idea of prosecuting people for their crimes.
Yeah, that's a point I'd love to get to. But I have to agree, stopping our own incineration via nuclear weapons should be a bipartisan issue. It's not a red blue issue or on some side of a political divide. It should be something we can all agree on, which is why you'd have, you know, summits like the No to NATO, Yes to Peace summit that's coming up. So, I mean, one can see why you would hold an event like this at this time. If NATO or if the United States had struck, you know, Russian nuclear detection radars back in 1962, you know, we wouldn't be here because the war would have started already at that point. So it's extraordinarily dangerous. Yes. And then you mentioned international law and what the role of NATO should be there. I understand that is an area that your book goes into. So what is the relationship between NATO and international law?
Yeah, by the way, the people who want to learn more and come to those events, you can go to nonatoyespeace.org, nonatoyespeace.org. And what we'll be gathering in Washington, D.C. will not be any legal institution whatsoever, not any global or international body, not any law enforcement agency, but essentially a criminal gang on the largest scale. The NATO Charter, which goes back to not long after the UN Charter, goes back to 1949, explicitly and repeatedly says, we are devoted to the UN Charter and resolving conflict peacefully and so forth, but then says, we're a military alliance, we're a war alliance, and if one of our members is in a war, the rest of our members are going to jump in and help, which doesn't exist in the UN Charter. The UN will supposedly allow wars that are defensive. And of course, some wars, you can make a good case that they are defensive, but there isn't any war where both sides don't make the case strongly or weakly that their fighting is defensive, or the UN will authorize a war, which it doesn't actually do. Nowhere does it say parties can go ahead and jump in on the side that they think is in the right. And when they feel everything's in place, go back home and let the United Nations take over again. This is, you know, complete lawlessness. And so when You know, sometimes there's a pretense, there's a fig leaf. There's, for example, a UN resolution that says you can protect civilians in Libya. And then NATO goes in and overthrows the government and bombs the place, you know, creates havoc for years to come. This is lawlessness. And people in the United States in huge numbers tend to think that if NATO does it, it's a little more legal, or it's downright legal. You know, if I go rob the corner grocery store, it doesn't become more legal if I bring 20 friends. But when NATO does it, when NATO attacks the nation of Libya, oh, well, now it's an international body. It's something like the United Nations. I'm not sure, but it involves lots of, oh, the international community. That's it. That legalizes it. And of course, it isn't representative of the globe, and it isn't elected by anyone. And although it bombs people in the name of democracy, there's nothing democratic about it. It includes members that don't have any pretense of democracy and partners, but it also doesn't make any of its decisions democratically. And it's a tool of the U.S. government, and it shouldn't be allowed to give the U.S. government that sort of cover. And the U.S. Congress shouldn't be allowed to say, oh, we have no need to investigate these atrocities. They're NATO atrocities. You know, this is the opposite of a lawful or a legalistic institution. This is an excuse to evade laws and violate laws on the largest scale.
Yes. For those who are just tuning in, I'm speaking with David Swanson, and he is the author, along with Medea Benjamin, of NATO, What You Need to Know. And yes, just on what you were saying there, David, we've seen statements in the last few weeks that corroborate what you're saying. In general, it's like the United States wants to use NATO to supersede the existing international law. So there's a UN and a UN charter, but suddenly NATO steps in. In the case of Libya, I distinctly remember how they, you know, really utilized a specific UN resolution 1973 to then go in and become the air force for an insurgency and change the government, regime change. That was one type of action. But you also see the United States simply at times saying they're going to ignore international law completely. There's been statements by recent spokespeople saying that U.S. sovereignty is higher than any international law. So it's a very fluid concept, it seems, for the United States and for NATO, and it seems to be utilized however it's convenient. Now, the book looks at how NATO is involving itself in so many areas of global life, whether it's the environment or economics, or, you know, trying to take a role in international law, interpreting the United Nations or superseding the United Nations. Along with the physical expansion of NATO, there's this expansion of its mandate, its professed role in global affairs, and it becomes an all-you-can-shop-stop where it takes care of all these things. So I'm wondering how that fits into what Claire Daly said about your book. Of course, Claire Daly is a wonderful MEP, and she said, read this book to understand how NATO promotes a logic of domination, not equality or justice or peace. So what is NATO doing when it involves itself in many areas of global governance?
It is sticking its nose where it has no right, and without representing or speaking for any portion of the world's population. I saw a State Department spokesperson recently claim that the International Court of Justice had no sovereignty and no power, no jurisdiction in Palestine, whereas the United States and NATO had jurisdiction in Palestine. Why? Because they provide the weapons. This is how they think. It's absolute madness. The International Criminal Court is issuing an arrest warrant for the Prime Minister of Israel. The U.S. Congress is inviting him to come speak, promising not only not to arrest him and extradite him to The Hague, but to cheer for him and provide him with unlimited weapons without question. You know, and this is this is the self-appointed leadership of the rules-based order, which doesn't just exclude itself from law, but seeks to tear it down, punishes nations for supporting international courts. And so NATO is filling its role as part of this U.S. enterprise to establish itself self-appointed without any say-so from anybody legitimate or representative as ruler of the world. NATO is largely, principally, a weapons-dealing institution, but it's also a military alliance with a wing that's seeking to expand into all other areas, into economics, into government, into science and research, trying to establish itself as an authority on all things in terms of global governance. And much of this is outside of its treaty that created it, but it's also outside of the United Nations and outside of any particular nation. And this is quite dangerous. You have routinely news stories about European presidents and prime ministers answering to NATO, bowing to NATO, making apologies to NATO. Canada has to answer to NATO's demand for how much it will spend on weapons. And if it doesn't spend a sufficient percentage of its economy, as if the richer you are, the more death and destruction you owe the world, then it has to answer to NATO, as if militarism were a public service. You know, this is not just the incredibly backward, misguided thinking that you need massive violence to defend yourself. This is the incredibly perverse humanitarian thinking that you need ever greater, limitless, massive violence as a public service to the rest of the world. And NATO is driving and funding so-called think tanks that teach us this. It's insidious, it's public and open, but it's also into all kinds of things that people don't quite realize.
Yeah, this growing involvement in global governance, all these different issues and affairs, it seems to be something that the global majority outside of the U.S., Great Britain, and so on, many people in the world seem increasingly upset by this NATO involvement in what should be United Nations, UN Charter, and so forth, on those kind of institutions. But you brought up a very relevant point as well for what people are concerned about at the moment and for the last number of months, which is Gaza. And you mentioned NATO having a role in essentially the bombardment devastation in Gaza. So it looks like you've been tracking that. What is NATO's role in the fighting or the events in Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, NATO has always sought to have political and economic influence. It has always opposed communism and socialism and demanded privatization and empire. And Israel has been an ally of NATO and NATO an ally of Israel from day one, from their births within a year of each other. NATO and Israel have been our partners. Israel is a NATO partner. It can't be a member because it's not in Europe. And it is one of the few nations that sells a lot of weapons to NATO and advises NATO on weaponry, as well as among most of the world's big war waging nations, a weapons customer from NATO. But the Prime Minister of Israel goes and meets with the Secretary General of NATO, this unelected hack, as if they are both the leaders of governments, and they commit allegiance to each other. And they are deeply enmeshed in the weapons industry that makes up actually the bulk of what NATO does. And they are integrating Israeli weaponry, battle tested on Palestinian families, with NATO weaponry, and making it all, as they call it, interoperable, so that you have NATO forces training and overseeing and upgrading weaponry in Israel and Israelis throughout the rest of NATO. And, you know, this is a problem for people who imagine NATO to be a European democratic elected North Atlantic peace society, because it has nothing to do with the North Atlantic and it has nothing to do with defense. And nobody's being asked for any input whatsoever. You know, not the people of Europe, but not even the governments of Europe.
Well, you've laid out a real case of why people should get involved in the rally that's coming up. You have the escalated risk of nuclear war, NATO getting involved in all sorts of things it shouldn't be, NATO being involved in Gaza and Libya and all sorts of places where devastation is occurring. So we have this rally coming up. It's going to be July 6th, July 7th. There's a website for it, nonatoyespeace.org, as you pointed out. So NATO is having meetings at that time. You're going to be having your own summit. So what are you hoping to achieve in this summit?
Well, NATO itself will be gathering with presidents and prime ministers and weapons CEOs galore in Washington, D.C., starting around July the 9th. We will be taking advantage of the weekend, July 6th and 7th, to hold a big conference on July the 6th in downtown Washington, D.C., with experts and people impacted by NATO from around the globe, including, you know, members of parliament from Germany and other NATO member countries who see differently from the actions engaged in, for the most part, by their governments. And we will be holding a rally on Sunday, July the 7th, in front of the White House with an incredible array of speakers and crowd and banners. And our purpose is to make clear to the world in the way that we try to do right now on the website, nonatoyespeace.org, that there's a problem with NATO, that there's a problem with this institution that is almost 70% of the world's militarism, that doesn't have a real enemy, but wants to insist on generating them and selling the weapons to combat them, and that we need to take a different course, and that a different course is possible, and that you can reinstate treaties, and that you can negotiate peace, and that you can disarm and cooperate and establish an actual rules-based order that's actually orderly with actual rules, without imagining that the Russian or Chinese or any other government is an angelic thing of beauty, but with the understanding that humans are equally flawed the world over and nonetheless need to do their best to ensure survival rather than acting as if they're hell-bent on destruction, as seems to be the case at the moment.
Yes, and there should be illuminating figures from all over, as you mentioned, a German MP. I saw that on the website. You have, I'm not sure exactly how to say her name, it's Sevim Dagdelen. She's the German MP. I've seen videos of her speaking. She's made some powerful statements about NATO and peace in Germany.
It's wonderful to have someone expressing the opinion of many Germans that peace would be a better way, that their country should not be, as their constitution forbids, a war-making country, that it shouldn't be pockmarked with U.S. occupation 75 years after a war supposedly ended, that people in the United States should understand that not everyone in Europe views NATO as a protective umbrella, but understands it as one side of an arms race that isn't needed and may kill us all. You know, this is much more widely understood in Europe and much of the world than many in the United States would like to imagine, including by MEPs, which people in the United States may never have heard of, but are members of the European Parliament. This is something that we hope to open some eyes and minds with, the fact that there are different perspectives, that the whole range of debate that one gets from U.S. media outlets leaves out massive areas of thought and opinion and action.
Yes, absolutely. And Europe is on the front line, much of it. And you do see some of that diversity of thought come out as a result of the urgency of the situation. And for Canadians, there should be some familiar faces at this summit as well. Tamara Lawrence is going to be there, I understand. She has a workshop, so people should check that out at nonatoyespeace.org. Get signed up to that. You can see Tamara and others and everybody, David and Savim, they're all going to be there. There's a variety of events taking place. First, I would encourage people to be part of that. But I also remember, of course, you have a book club coming up for the book for NATO, What You Need to Know. Not everybody knows about this, but there's a kind of special, you know, sign up, get tickets forum where people can discuss the book in a number of sessions. So obviously your book goes into a great deal of detail about numerous subjects related to NATO, and there's a lot to digest in there. And what better to do than have the author take you through it? This is a book club where people can sign up at the World Beyond War website. And because it's on Zoom, this is something that anyone could participate in, even Canadians. Is that right?
Absolutely. And if you go to worldbeyondwar.org, you'll see that we have free public webinars coming up, one on June 15th about NATO that will also talk about the upcoming events in July. We have a free public 24-hour Zoom call, Peace Wave, with live actions from around the world moving east to west around the globe, June 22nd and 23rd. We have the events in Washington, D.C., July 6th and 7th, and then that book club. We do one with a different author and a different book every month. This one, I think, is going to be in August, so it'll be after the events of July. But for any of the book clubs, people can sign up at worldbeyondwar.org/bookclubs. And buy a ticket, you get a book, you get access to the sessions. And my co-author, Medea Benjamin, will join me for at least one of the four book club sessions about NATO, What You Need to Know.
Oh, very good. That should be interesting. Well, I would encourage people to do that. Then check out the World Beyond War website and not only the summit, but of course the tours, the peace tours that are going on with World Beyond War and various women's organizations and Voice of Women for Peace in Canada. There are actually numerous events going on right now from the present all the way through June, with book clubs going into August and so forth. So there is going to be a consistent series of events related to NATO and peace and tours and summits. So nonatoyespeace.org is where you can find out about the summit in Washington. And of course, you can look up NATO, What You Need to Know with David Swanson and Medea Benjamin, and you can get the book and you can even join the book club there to participate in meetings about it. So David, I wanted to thank you very much for being on the program with us today.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.